Roughly Speaking with Dan Rogics is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy welcomes Jeffrey Kluger, whose new book, Apollo 8, presents the untold story of the historic moon voyage, a national triumph that brought us the iconic Earthrise photo and closed out one of the darkest years in modern American history. Wednesday, November 1st at 7 p.m. More at theivybookshop.com or call 410-377-2966.
Hello again from the Baltimore Sun. I'm Dan Rogics, and this is Roughly Speaking, episode 316. It's Friday, the 27th day of October, 2017, and we're opening with some different music today to set the mood, get you psyched for the weekend, and maybe a good meal or two. We're cooking on the show today. Well, we're talking about cooking on the show today, but with a cool guest, David Tanis, an accomplished chef and cookbook author who writes the City Kitchen column in the food section of the New York Times. David Tanis has produced an excellent new cookbook called Market Cooking. That is, looking for the best your local farmer's market or supermarket or food hall has to offer, then taking that home and applying a simple but inspired recipe. Market Cooking has 225 recipes and excellent photos. I've seen a lot of good cookbooks, and this is one of the best, with an emphasis on vegetables. David Tanis has cooked from California to France. He was chef at Chez Panisse in Berkeley for 25 years. Today, a conversation with David about his new book, and we'll hear some excerpts from a few of his recipes. I love this idea of the market cooking. You go to the market without any real strong preconceived notions about what you want to cook for your friends on Saturday night or Sunday, and you see what looks good, what's fresh, and you go with that, right? That's basically it, isn't it?
That's the whole deal. It's not difficult. You go and see what looks good, then you take it home and cook it. I mean, you might go with an idea of what you're going to have for Saturday dinner, but you should be prepared to throw the plan out.
And you might know, you probably will know, what's fresh, what's likely to be fresh at certain times of the year, right? What's seasonal? For instance, parsnips, turnips coming in, root vegetables coming in this time of year in the fall as we head toward Thanksgiving. Those things will be commonly seen now.
Oh, yeah. But with that, we're at kind of this great sort of on the cusp of autumn, even though it is autumn, but it's been so warm in the Northeast that all the summer produce is, you know, still there.
Yeah, we're still getting tomatoes in my backyard. Yeah. Okay, so let me ask you about a couple of things, because the recipes, I'm really impressed with these recipes because I would say they're inventive, they're creative, and still simple. I didn't come across anything that stumped me, that intimidated me.
There's not a recipe in the book that a home cook couldn't make easily.
As long as you have turmeric.
Well,
just throw that one in.
There's not turmeric in every dish.
There's not. I'm just kidding.
But there are a few.
Let me start with a simple one that I tried, which really surprised me. Radishes. So I was at a farmer's market, not here in Baltimore, but in Western Maryland, that's getting ready to close up for the season. And there's Amish farmers there. There were radishes. And I didn't expect to see radishes in the fall. I don't know why. I guess you can plant them multiple times during the year. I usually just associate them with the spring being fresh.
They don't take that long to grow, so you kind of keep them going.
Yeah. I got your book the same weekend I was attending this market, so I bought the radishes. And I found one recipe in here for stewed radishes, stewed in a buttery broth.
Put the radishes in a wide skillet and season well with salt and pepper. Add the butter and water and bring to a boil over high heat. Cover, reduce the heat to a brisk simmer, and cook the radishes until just tender when pierced with a paring knife, about 5 minutes. Remove the lid, raise the heat, and boil to evaporate most of the liquid. Adjust the seasoning to taste and serve the radishes in the buttery juices, sprinkled with the dill.
I mean, it's the way that I cook a lot of vegetables. Not that I like to use that much butter. I think I'm more olive oil in most ways, but for tender vegetables, it's nice to just, you know, put an inch of water in the pot and a knob of butter, and then simmer the vegetable in that buttery liquid.
It ended up being the taste of a mild turnip.
Yeah, it's interesting. Cooking radishes, you would think they would be strong tasting, but they're not.
No.
And it's a pleasant
It was lovely.
Yeah.
So I will try that again. Do you remember how you developed that recipe? Does it just come from a habit of yours of lightly buttered stew of vegetables? Or
I guess so, but I mean, you couldn't exactly call this a very developed recipe. It's also not, you know,
it's pretty simple.
There's nothing in the book that isn't simple, but there's also nothing in the book that's especially new. Maybe my approach to putting things together is slightly different from some other cooks, but really, there's nothing new under the sun.
I don't know. I think you're selling yourself short there a little bit. I never thought of cooking radishes.
Yeah.
If anybody in my audience has cooked radishes before, give me a ring or drop me an email.
I'm kind of crazy for radishes anyway, raw or cooked. And daikon radish is delicious cooked as well.
Another thing I would say about the book is the emphasis on the vegetables. We're talking about vegetables today, but the book isn't completely just about vegetables. There's fish involved in here, and there's pork, and there's chicken. But you seem to want to celebrate the vegetable as much as whatever the main course is. People tend to think of vegetables as being the side, right?
I always think of vegetables as being the most interesting part of the meal.
Yeah, they're so colorful, number one. Start with that.
And, you know, there's such a, you know, a variety of vegetables, and each one tastes good. Some vegetables are available throughout the year, and many are only available at certain times of the year, which also makes gives you something to look forward to.
Coming into the fall and Thanksgiving season, the root vegetables, I wanted to focus on that a bit because there are a few, when people hear the term, they think, oh, well, not everybody likes turnips. Not everybody likes parsnips. Am I going to serve turnips at Thanksgiving? What do I do with this to make it a little more interesting? Or even just the simple potato. So mm-hmm. Let's take one at a time. I like to talk a little bit about the turnip, which I love, and I use it in soup. I use it, you know, just boiled and mashed like potatoes usually. I haven't done a whole lot more with turnips other than that.
Mashed turnips are great. Boiled and buttered turnips are great too. But, you know, boiling turnips can sometimes result in a watery kind of turnip. And a lot of times people overcook turnips. They're good at any stage of the game, but sometimes if you leave them just a little on the firmer side, you know, done, but just a little bit firmer, you may like them better. I learned from a guy who went off to France and came back with this recipe called, he learned it in France, so he called it turnip confit. You take the larger round turnips that you see in the market in the wintertime or in the supermarket, usually see them on a shelf looking sort of, well, not inviting. But if you take them home and peel them and slice them thin and you begin to sauté them in the pan in a large skillet and just keep turning them over and over and over. And as they cook, you're not adding any liquid actually, just a lump of butter or a glug of olive oil and some salt. But as they begin to cook and break down, they also get caramelized in the process. And since you're not adding any liquid, it's just concentrating the flavor. But it's a really delicious way to cook turnips.
There's a very inviting photograph of that in your book. Discs, very thinly sliced, and a bit crispy and caramelized.
Well, definitely caramelized, but
not too crispy.
But not crisp.
Okay.
Although, I mean,
the picture makes them look a little bit like that. Okay. That does sound good. Can you do the same with parsnips?
Parsnips, I would do them a little differently, but I love. Well, let's see. Is there a vegetable I don't love? But I really, but I really love parsnips. Roasted. What I like to do is cut them in chunks, roast them, and just sort of half mash them. But cut in chunks, toss with olive oil and salt and pepper, and roasted for, you know, 30-40 minutes. Absolutely delicious. They have this kind of otherworldly aroma, and a really delicious earthy flavor that nothing else tastes like. Nothing else tastes like a parsnip.
Parsnips with turmeric and feta.
A little bit of an odd combination, but really awfully good.
Bring a large pot of well-salted water to a boil. Peel the parsnips and quarter lengthwise. With a paring knife, remove the tough central cores. Cut the parsnips into 3-inch batons. Parboil for 2 minutes, then drain and spread out on a baking sheet to cool. Heat the oven to 400 degrees. Use the softened butter to butter a 9x12-inch earthenware baking dish. Arrange the parsnips in the dish. Whisk together the cream, turmeric, and cumin. Season with salt and pepper and the cayenne. Pour the cream mixture over the parsnips and sprinkle with the feta. Bake the parsnips for about 30 minutes until bubbling and nicely browned.
When we get to potatoes, some of those recipes I thought, this is pretty fundamental, but there's something about what you present in terms of the preparation for them, like the pan-fried potatoes, yellow potatoes, or the French potato salad that involves anchovies. It's really interesting territory. You really made it interesting.
In the book, vegetables are divided into little chapters of their own, so there's the turnip chapter or the carrot chapter.
And then there's the potato chapter.
But the potato chapter is one of the bigger chapters.
It is.
And the salad chapter is one of the bigger chapters as well, because I had to take a few potato recipes back out because I like them so much that I was inclined to put more potato recipes in.
Garlicky pork and potatoes. I like the word garlicky. You love garlic. So do I love garlic. Garlic needs to be there at the very beginning of almost everything, doesn't it?
I think so, yeah.
In a large, shallow baking dish, big enough to hold the pork chops, arrange the potato slices as for a gratin, overlapping them. Arrange the pork chops on top or set the roast on the potatoes. Add enough broth to come halfway up the sides of the baking dish. Cover the dish tightly with foil and bake for 20 minutes. Reduce the heat to 350 degrees and cook for 20 minutes more. Take off the foil and bake for 20 minutes or until the potatoes have browned on top and the pork has crisped.
And the classic potato gratin, or some people say au gratin, looks great. Mashed potato variations.
Well, there's one that just adds a lot of chopped scallions and a little butter.
Yeah.
Of course.
And the photograph of the golden pan-fried potatoes, that's what I was referring to before. Boy, if you can do this well, if you can do this right, you will delight all your guests if you can do that right.
Everybody likes crispy fried potatoes.
Oh, man.
Boil the potatoes in a large pot of well-salted water for 10 minutes or until cooked through but still firm. Put 2 large cast iron skillets over medium-high heat and add 1/2 inch of clarified butter to each one. Carefully add the potatoes to the pans in one layer and adjust the heat to keep them frying briskly. Resist touching them until they begin to brown on the bottom and loosen from the pan about 8 minutes. Gently turn them with a slotted spoon or spatula and let them cook for another 8 minutes or until they're beautifully golden. Lift the potatoes from the cooking oil and blot them on paper towels.
So how did you get carrots and coconut together? I was curious about that. Do you remember the day that happened?
Well, yes, I remember it well. I was going through a phase where I was cooking a lot with coconut oil because it's so aromatic and delicious. And now that they've decided it's not bad for you, it's fun to cook with, especially if you're using Asian ingredients. And so I wanted to come up with a carrot dish that was spicy and coconutty. So it's you get the coconut flavor both from the coconut oil, but also from some little pieces of coconut added at the end.
He Heat the oven to 400 degrees. Peel the carrots and cut into 2-inch batons. Put them on a baking sheet, season well with salt and pepper, and drizzle with the coconut oil. Spread out the carrots and roast, uncovered, until they are lightly brown and tender when pierced, 20 to 25 minutes. The carrots can be roasted up to 3 hours in advance and held at room temperature, then reheated. Transfer the hot carrots to a serving dish. Add the chili and mint and toss to distribute. Sprinkle with cilantro and a squeeze of lime juice and top with the coconut slivers.
Is there a recipe in the book that you especially like, that you're proud of, that was a kind of a revelation even for you?
Yeah, let me think about that for a minute.
These are all your babies.
I think there are about 200 recipes, and so I think I don't know if I have a very favorite one, but the one you're looking at right now is awfully good. It's that shaved raw radish salad that just has 4 ingredients.
With a mandolin or a sharp knife, slice the radishes as thin as possible. Arrange the slices on a platter. Sprinkle lightly with salt. Use a sea salt with texture. If the creme fraiche is quite thick, beat it with a spoon for a minute to loosen it, or thin with a few drops of milk or water. Spoon it generously over the sliced radishes. Finish with as much freshly ground pepper as you like.
So there are two non-root recipes I just wanted to mention that I appreciated. One is the broccoli rabe lasagna.
Mm.
Now, lasagna is a heavenly dish if it's done right, but broccoli rabe, I am a big fan of broccoli rabe. I should work for the Broccoli Rabe Council. I can't get enough of it. It's a bit pricey, I've noticed. It's gotten pricier in the market, I guess, because it comes from California and a limited market for it.
A lot of the broccoli rabe you see is grown in California,
but
in season you see a lot grown on the East Coast as well.
I don't see enough. I've been trying to encourage farmers around Maryland to grow broccoli rabe. I feel I should start a commune and just grow broccoli rabe or something.
Well,
I should at least grow it in my backyard.
Well, you could be competition for that one great big broccoli rabe grower out.
Andy Boy?
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's a wonderful green. I just love the flavor. My mother cooked it. It reminds me of, you know, growing up and all. But I usually don't do much with it other than just saute it in olive oil and garlic. I don't even put it in water.
Yeah. Anybody who has Italian heritage usually just loves broccoli rabe.
To assemble the lasagna, put a layer of cooked noodles on the bottom of the baking dish. Spoon a quarter of the bechamel sauce over the noodles, then dot with a third of the ricotta. Complete the layer with 1/3 of the chopped broccoli rabe, a good drizzle of pesto, and about 1/4 of the grated cheese. Continue the layering, finishing with a layer of pasta. Spread the last of the bechamel on top and sprinkle with the remaining Parmesan. Cover the pan with foil and bake for 20 minutes. Uncover and bake for 20 minutes more, or until nicely browned on top and bubbling. Let lasagna rest for 10 minutes before serving.
You know, it has a certain slight bitterness. And just a certain kind of, well, there's kind of a sweet almond, sort of almond flavor.
Yeah, there's that. It's a little bit spicy.
Yeah, it's got, you know, because, you know, it's a mustard green, so it has some kick to it as well.
Yeah.
But layered in a lasagna with ricotta and other things, it's quite delicious. But that particular dish also has a broccoli rabe pesto. And I, of course, thought I had invented that until I found out that, of course, lots of other people have made broccoli rabe pestos, but it's really quite delicious. And I mean, simply when you make the broccoli rabe pesto, you blanch, you briefly cook it in salted water, squeeze it out, and then pound or puree it with olive oil and garlic to a pesto-like consistency. And I want to tell you that even just using that pesto for a plain plate of spaghetti,
yeah,
is insanely good.
No, that's thing I picked up from that recipe. I'd never even thought of that before.
It adds another dimension.
My goodness. Thank you, David. And the other one I want to thank you for is black beans, chorizo, and squid.
Mm.
And I have a Portuguese side to me that this reminds me of, seafood with the sausage together, with, of course, the black beans, more Brazilian than maybe mainland Portugal. But, that all sounds good. It's a great-looking recipe.
Well, I think that's in the bean.
In the bean chapter.
That's in the bean chapter.
Yeah.
The beans can be cooked up to 2 days in advance and refrigerated in their liquid. When ready to serve, reheat the beans by combining them in a saucepan with 1 cup of their cooking liquid and simmering them over medium heat to reduce and thicken the bean broth. Slice the squid bodies crosswise into 1-inch pieces. Split any larger clusters of tentacles in half. Rinse the squid, drain in a colander, and pat dry. Spread out on a plate or baking sheet and season generously with salt and black pepper. Heat the olive oil in a large skillet over medium-high heat. Add the chorizo and cook for a minute or so to release some of the tasty fat. Then add the garlic and crushed red pepper and let sizzle for 10 seconds. Raise the heat to high, add the squid, and cook, stirring constantly until the squid is puffed and just cooked through about 2 minutes. Remove from the heat and stir in the scallions, parsley, and lemon zest and juice. Spoon the warm beans onto a platter. Top with the squid and all the juices from the pan. Garnish with the breadcrumbs if you like.
I wanted to come up with a dish using black beans that might be slightly different from what people are used to. And I'm a big squid fan. It turned out that Well, the black beans kind of look like squid ink in a way. You get this little bit. And they also have not the consistency of squid ink, but they have a little bit of that sort of inky depth, I guess.
Yeah.
So to sauté the squid with a lot of olive oil and garlic and hot pepper and chorizo, and then all of that delicious oil sort of spills into the black beans, it looks good and it tastes good.
I love white beans, too. Cannellini beans. And fava beans when you can get them. Now, some people are a little intimidated by dealing with fava beans, especially the fresh ones in the summer. But it's not that hard, and it's worth the effort.
Oh, it's definitely worth the effort, definitely. I don't think fava beans actually made it into this particular volume, but in every other book I've written, fava beans have figured largely.
I've used cannellini beans in a simple, like a bruschetta with tuna. Fresh if you have some leftover from grilling tuna or just even out of a can with capers and olive oil and some parsley as a spread on crusty Italian bread.
Can we have some of that right now?
Doesn't that sound good?
Yes.
And I also want to compliment you on this thing. This seems so simple, and I think now I'm eager to try it. With toasted bread, this is a Spain tradition, right? Spanish tradition of a toasted Italian bread or something, and with a rub of garlic on it. Take a fresh clove of garlic, skinned, right?
Yeah, peeled garlic clove.
Clove, and just rub it against already toasted bread. Right?
Yes. I mean, just after it comes out of the toaster, out of the toaster oven, off the grill, wherever you've made your beautiful toast with your beautiful bread, then you just give it a few swipes, and you'll notice that if you look at the garlic clove, you'll see that, part of it has disappeared because it's been grated essentially right into the bread.
Right.
It's the best, easiest garlic bread.
Mm.
Of course, you want to give it a little drizzle of olive oil, too.
And then you can take a sliced tomato or cut a tomato in half and actually rub the tomato on the toast as well.
Yes. And then you can lay a little anchovy fillet over the top. And then you should open a bottle of red wine.
Yeah. Which red do we want with that?
Mm.
A Spanish red?
Spanish, Italian, French.
Yeah. This is fun. So good cooking. I'm really impressed with this book. Is this your biggest book? Is this the most ambitious one? I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with the earlier books.
Well, you can collect them all.
I plan to now because I'm so impressed with Market Cooking. But this looks pretty ambitious to me, and it's also beautifully done by artists in publishing.
This is the biggest one, I guess. We wanted to really fill it with a lot of photographs. So, I mean, I think it probably has 300 photographs and a couple of hundred recipes.
I'm curious about the recipes. Have most of those recipes been tried in restaurants where you worked, or are these developed mainly for the book, for your guests at home?
Well, I mean, I don't know. They sort of span the lifetime of cooking. I mean, if it's the only book of mine that you have, then you could kind of consider it, in a way, the best of. And so I have a garlic soup that I put in every book I write because it's so good and so easy.
This soup is insanely good. The ingredients are nothing more than a lot of garlic, some sage leaves, water, a little olive oil, and salt and pepper. It takes only 10 to 15 minutes to cook, but when you taste it, you'll swear it is a long, simmered, garlicky chicken broth. Warm the oil in a heavy pot over medium heat, add the garlic and sage, and let sizzle a bit without browning, about 2 minutes. Season with about 1 teaspoon salt and a few grinds of pepper. Add the water and bring to a boil. Lower to a brisk simmer and cook for 10 to 15 minutes until the garlic has mellowed slightly and the broth is flavorful.
Mostly what I'm after with this book is to get people inspired to cook, and well, get them inspired to go to the market and to get excited about vegetables. I mean, the focus of the book is pretty much all vegetable, but of course, you know, you always have something else with your vegetables, and so there, you know, there's the odd bit of flesh or fish. But
mostly it's the focus on vegetables.
Yeah.
That's why I like it.
I want people to be able to open the book, look at a picture, and say, that looks delicious and I want to make it. And then they can read the recipe and understand that they can make it because there aren't too many ingredients, and the techniques are just techniques that any home cook would already understand.
Also, there's this. I don't get as daring about cooking as I should, even though I know some of the recipes are simple. You go to the market, you see Swiss chard, and you want to take some home because it's good for you. It looks good. It's nice and green, right? But you stuck for a recipe and then don't make the effort to go read somebody's idea for it, and you're stuck with the same treatment of it. I'm guilty of that. And there's really no excuse for it because there's so many good recipes around for Swiss chard.
It's not a sin, but it's also, I mean, chard is a wonderful green. I have a friend in France who would much rather eat chard than spinach.
Yeah.
I want them, actually, I like them equally.
Same here. But you know what I mean? Maybe you don't know what I mean because you're always thinking about a new way of presenting it, a new way of cooking it. You can get lazy and, supper time is supposed to be 6:30 and it's 5 o'clock and you don't want to make the effort, so you end up boiling it, sautéing it, and garlic and butter again.
Sometimes tried and true is a good way to go, and then
yeah.
It's nice to stretch out a little bit.
Yeah. If you experiment on your own family, it's okay. It's when you have guests, it gets a little intimidating.
Well, when you have guests, it's a good idea to cook what you know. It's less stressful. If it's a recipe that you're cooking for the first time, it might be a good idea to make it once and then figure out which turn you took that might not have been the best turn.
Thank you, David.
Thank you so much.
Chef David Tanis writes the City Kitchen column for the New York Times. His 2008 book, A Platter of Figs and Other Recipes, has been widely acclaimed, and he's written a couple of other good ones since then. His new book is Market Cooking, published by Artisan. I hope you get inspired to hit the farmer's market this weekend and find something good to cook. Special thanks to Brittany Brito of the Sun Features staff for reading excerpts of David Tanis' recipes. And that's our show for now. For producers Steve Early, Quinn Kelly, and Christina Tasek, I'm Dan Rodericks. Thanks for listening to Roughly Speaking, and have a great weekend.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy welcomes Lori Frankel, author of This Is How It Always Is, the story of 5-year-old Claude, a lover of peanut butter sandwiches, dresses, and princesses. Claude is a boy who feels like a girl, and his family only wants him to be himself. The question is, how will the world respond? Monday, October 30th at 7 p.m. at The Ivy. More at theivybookshop.com or call 410-377-2966.